Bonjour, you restless Declans, and welcome to the Blind Boy podcast. If you're a brand new listener to this podcast, if this is your first podcast, I recommend going back and listening to some earlier podcasts, or even starting at the start of the podcast. But you can really pick any episode you like. They're all different, and they're not sequential. But in doing so, you get to familiarise yourself with the lore of this podcast. If you're a regular listener, you know the crack. How are you? I hope you've had a lovely week. The weather is getting much, much better. The days are longer. The air smells better. It's warmer. It's at that level of warmth where, like, I've got two cats up my back garden, and when cats lie down in the warm sun with their bellies in the air, it looks like they're sweating. But I don't think they are sweating. I don't think cats can sweat. But it's definitely sweaty cat weather where a reclining cat in the May sun takes on the appearance of sweating. It's performative cat sweat weather. So I've got a particularly nice treat for you this week in this week's podcast. I sat down and I had a chat with a neuroscientist by the name of Sabina Brennan. And Sabina she's a neuroscientist, she's a health psychologist, and she's also a science communicator. And most importantly, she's an expert in her field, but she's incredibly passionate about the field that she's in, which is neuroscience. So this week's episode is going to be all about the human brain. The human brain. Because I speak about mental health on this podcast, but I don't know much about the actual brain. I speak about the abstraction of emotions. But Sabina is an expert in the actual human brain. And it's very, very fascinating. It's very fascinating. And I learned quite a lot of stuff I did not know about before. Sabina is also a podcast host. She hosts a podcast called the Super Brain Podcast. She is a best-selling author. She's written 100 Days to a Younger Brain and a book called Beating Brain Fog. So this podcast really is about the human brain. And Sabina gives some wonderful insight and tips into how we can train our brains and make them healthier, and how our brains do the things they do and why. We speak about anxiety, depression, creativity, the importance of sleep, dementia, trauma, loads of stuff. And it was a very helpful conversation for me from kind of a self-help perspective. So one thing I would like to say before I get into this podcast, just to let ye know that I'm kind of continually aware of this. So this podcast, I bring up cognitive behavioral therapy a couple of times. We mention mindfulness. I think we touch on the importance of exercise. And I speak a lot about exercise, mindfulness, CBT. And these things are incredibly helpful for me. They really work for me, and that's why I speak about them. But like, in the context of a mental health pandemic, let's just call it that because that's what it is. In the context of a mental health pandemic in Ireland, and also in the context of, we don't really have a robust mental health system at the moment. A lot of people feel failed by the mental health system. A lot of people can't access the appropriate mental health services that they need. There's very long queues. In that context, sometimes things like mindfulness, exercise, CBT, they can be quite insulting to people, because lots of people go to their doctors or go to professionals and say, I'm suffering. And because services aren't adequate, often people are just told, do some mindfulness, do some exercise, or do some CBT, because you can read that out of a book. And that approach is really failing a lot of people. The thing is, with mental health or with mental illness, everyone is unique, and people need an approach that suits their individual needs, which is overseen by a professional or a full team of mental health professionals. So when you start roaring, start shouting out exercise, mindfulness, CBT, that's not very helpful to someone who's in a severe sense of crisis. Like somebody who might be dealing with complex issues around trauma or something like that, telling them go home and do some CBT via self-help or do some mindfulness, you know, look up some mindfulness videos on YouTube. That's really inappropriate and a sign of a system that's in failure. So I'd like you to know that that's in my awareness when I speak about these things. And also I'd ask of you, because this is a kind of a trend I'm seeing online, don't get angry with CBT exercise or mindfulness. Don't get angry with these things because they are helpful. Like CBT is an evidence-based approach. So don't get angry with these things. Get angry with a system that is presenting these things as the only solution because of a lack of resources. Do you get me? I say this too because I'm aware that there's people who listen to this podcast because their doctors have told them to listen to this podcast. I get mails every so often where people will say, I came to your podcast because my counsellor told me to listen to you, or my doctor told me to listen to you, because they say Blind Boy speaks about mental health, listen to him, it might help. Now, that's fantastic. I love to think that me speaking about my experiences can help some people. But on the other hand, that's really sad and troubling because I'm not a mental health professional. I studied it a little bit, but I'm just someone with a plastic bag on his head who speaks about their own experiences. And it upsets me that sometimes people are sent to this podcast because the alternative is 6 month queue to get appropriate services. It shouldn't be the case. I'd like people to listen to this podcast in conjunction with receiving appropriate services for their individual needs. And I never want to be Mr. Mindfulness, Mr. Exercise, Mr. CBT. I understand that these things don't work for everybody, and it can be quite insulting to somebody who needs something much more robust and tailored for them. Like, I did nearly 2 years of psychotherapy with a professional, like talk therapy, before I was able to even consider something like CBT. Because when I entered therapy, I didn't have any language for my emotions. I didn't know what I was feeling. I was experiencing agoraphobia. I was in real crisis. And talk therapy over time got me to a point where I was then in the position to help myself with exercise, mindfulness, CBT. But it was only through access to services in college that I got to that point. So I don't want to interrupt the chat I'm having with Sabina with the mid-podcast advert that Acast inserts. So we're going to have our little ocarina pause right now before I get into the chat, okay? I'm going to use a shaker instead of an ocarina this week to mix things up. So you're going to hear an advert now. That was the shake.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Pause. You would have heard an advert there for some products you may or may not need. I don't know. The advert was digitally inserted. I don't know what it was. Support for this podcast comes from you, the listener, via the Patreon page. Patreon.com/TheBlindBoy Podcast. This podcast is my full-time job. This podcast is how I earn a living. Most weeks I put out quite a long monologue-type essay that requires a huge amount of research, so that's why it's my full-time job. I adore doing it. I love it. I love making this podcast because each week I put out something that I genuinely care about, that I genuinely want to make. And if you're enjoying that, if you listen to this podcast and you like it, just please consider paying me for the work that I'm doing. If you met me in real life, would you buy me a pint or a cup of coffee? If the answer is yes, that's what I'm looking for. The equivalent of a price of a pint or a cup of coffee once a month. You can do it on patreon.com/theblindbuypodcast. Okay? If you can't afford that, you don't have to. You can listen for free. If you can afford it, you're paying for the person who can't afford it. So everybody gets a podcast. I earn a living. And it's a wonderful model based on kindness and soundness. And it gives me a sense of certainty in my life because I can plan, I can financially plan in my life. It's wonderful. Another reason you should be a patron of this podcast is it keeps the podcast independent, by which I mean no advertiser tells me what to speak about or what I should do. And I can tell an advertiser to fuck off if they try, which is a wonderful sense of freedom. And the podcast space in general right now is, it's really under threat because all you got to do is look at the podcast charts of the past year. It's oversaturated with all of these brand new podcasts that have big celebrity names and there's huge money behind them. So traditional media spaces like newspapers, TV, radio, they're pumping all their budgets now into podcasts. But that doesn't necessarily mean that those podcasts are good. Podcasts for me were always about small independent productions where the person making it or the small team that's making it really care about what they're making. And that's what made podcasts magical. You're listening to people being really passionate. And I got into podcasting to move away from the more mainstream spaces that are dominated by profit and listenership, where making something that you really care about is impossible. So the podcast space is kind of, small independent podcasts are being drowned out and are becoming invisible. And now you just have this kind of mainstream noise going on where the overall quality of podcasts is being reduced. So support independent podcasts, not just mine, whatever independent podcast you're listening to and you're enjoying, support that podcast, all right? If you want to support me, patreon.com/theblindbuypodcast. I really, really appreciate it. And thank you so much to all my patrons. Catch me on Twitch Thursday nights, twitch.tv/theblindbuypodcast, where I make live music to the events of a video game. Leave a review of the podcast on whatever podcast app you're doing or using. Share the podcast with your friends or just tell a friend about it. That stuff helps as well. Yurt. So just wanted to flag that before I get into this podcast, which is really fucking interesting conversation with a neuroscientist about the human brain and about things that we can do to help our brains and to help our emotions. So here's the chat, Dr. Sabina Brennan. Check her out. Check out her podcast, the Super Brain Podcast, and her website, which is sabinabrennan.ie, where you can see all her books and stuff. All right, Sabina Brennan, you are a neuroscientist. And before we get into the chat, can you just describe to me what is a neuroscientist?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's actually kind of an umbrella, term. And it describes anybody, I suppose academics, anybody who studies the human brain, physiologists, people looking at physical aspects of the brain. It can, microbiologists, people from all angles. But I'm actually a health psychologist, and my interest is the relationship between the brain and human behavior. I'm just interested in what makes us do what we do and be who we are. I'm just fascinated, actually. I love people, and I'm kind of, well, no, that's a lie. I don't love people. I love I love understanding why people do what they do. And the brain holds all the answers as far as I'm concerned.
Is it fair to say, is neuroscience the person who deals with the physical parts of the computer rather than the software?
No, that's kind of a good analogy, because they often use that analogy in neuroscience, you know, that you have the hardware and the software. So like your brain, you know, the neurons and the connections between it being the hardware, and then the software being what you do with it, you know, the cognitive functions like, you know, memory and thinking and emotions. But it's kind of artificial link because they are all one. Do you know that kind of way? So no, people kind of, people study different aspects. I suppose some people, physiologists and other sort of more what they'll call wet sciences, you know, people in a laboratory looking at, you know, looking at a number of the cells and how they work. And
like, do you ever have to look at an actual brain?
No, I don't, you see. No, no. So what? Well, that's a lie. I don't look at an actual physical brain, but like, say, my PhD was. and I get the title now. Hang on. Neurocognitive and electrophysiological indices of cognitive function in aging. So basically, I actually looked. Being a euphemism for looked at the human brain, looked at the electrical activity in the human brain. So, you know, like you can get an ECG for your heart, you know, where they put those stickers on your heart and they can see the electrical functioning in your brain, in your heart. Well, that's kind of what I did for my PhD, stuck sort of 64 electrodes on people's heads and looked at the electrical activity in their brain as they carried out memory tests and attention tests and all sorts of different activities. And so whilst you can kind of see lines going up and down when you're recording that, you actually then have to take it away and do this huge kind of mathematical, really boring analysis to look for patterns that are linked to when somebody was doing a particular thing, like remembering a specific word.
This is something I'd like to know about, actually. So I saw someone getting brain surgery on the TV. It was real, but the person was like a violin player.
Yeah.
And they operated on their brain while the person was playing violin.
Really?
What's that about?
Well, I haven't seen it. But I know certainly before you have brain surgery, so like say people who have epilepsy. May need to have brain surgery because they have the electrical signal in their brain. I should say to people before we kind of go a bit further, because I don't know whether your listeners know how the brain kind of works and how. But basically, you've got 86 billion neurons in your brain, 86 billion brain cells and trillions of connections. And they communicate with each other and with the cells in the rest of your body through electrical and chemical signals. So that's how the brain works. It's really, really incredible. And so basically what you were saying sort of about surgery. So if someone, say, has epilepsy, the electrical signaling goes haywire, you know, and they might get, they have too much electrical activity going. It's like an electrical storm and they have their fit and things go wrong. So sometimes they want to go in and do a little bit of surgery on that. But they have to be very careful that if they're operating on the brain, they don't actually, you know, damage a part of the brain that's critical to your brain functioning. I mean, obviously, you need every part of your brain. But the thing is with the brain, roughly speaking, we know where different activities take place. So like language will be roughly in the same place in my brain as it is in your brain. But because your brain is constantly changing, right? So you're not stuck with the brain you were born with, right? In fact, you've really got a completely different brain from the brain you were born with, because your brain is constantly changing and it's your behaviors, your experiences, the life choices that you make that can shape your brain.
Could we compare it to a muscle in any way? Like if I do a bunch of exercises for my chest, I will grow my chest.
Yes.
But if I neglect my arms, I won't grow my arms.
Yes.
Is the brain similar?
Yes. It's not a muscle. It's not a muscle, but it is absolutely similar. Yes. So basically what you have is the brain has this incredible capacity to learn. That's how we have evolved as a species. We have adapted and changed to our environment. So adapting and changing to your environment is learning. That's what learning is. Okay. Mm-hmm. So basically the brain has this incredible capacity to adapt and change with learning. And that's called neuroplasticity. So the brain is described as being plastic. So not credit card plastic. Think of Mala, mm-hmm. you know, plasticine that you pulled and played around with in school. But basically in response to learning new information or experiencing something new in the environment, your brain has the capacity to grow new connections. And that actually is what physically changes the architecture of your brain. So if you actually, you just mentioned a musician there.
Yeah.
So, you know, the areas in the brain of a musician who is constantly practicing, you know, music will be very different to that area in someone like me who doesn't play music. Like there's a fabulous study, and I love quoting this study because it was carried out by an Irish woman in the UK. And it's a very well-known study, but it kind of explains, helps to explain neuroplasticity in a really simple way. In fact, I made a little animation of it. So if you want to throw in the show notes, I'll kind of, you know, just look up superbrain.ie. There's lots of little animations. But this one explains a study that was done on London taxi drivers. So basically, this woman, Mary Maguire, studies had been done looking at a part of the brain in homing pigeons. It's called the hippocampus, and it's involved in learning and memory. And it's also involved in what we call spatial navigation. So that's you just, you know, walking around in the environment, sitting in the environment, like that's your brain is doing that. It's constantly looking and making judgments about where you are relative to that wall or that door or whatever. So they noticed that the hippocampus in homing pigeons was much bigger than the hippocampus in regular pigeons who don't race and go home. And so that alerted them to that.
Separate breeds, or is it just one pigeon trained?
I don't think so. I have no idea. That's a really brilliant question. I have no idea. But I think, I think homing pigeons are just trained. But I would imagine they breed them then as well. Mm-hmm. But I would imagine they originally came from, you know, just regular pigeons. But that's something I must look up. But anyway, so that kind of led to them realizing, okay, that's involved in spatial navigation. And similarly, there's lots of fab little stories about, you know, birds that hide their food in the winter time. You know, it grows when they actually have to, you know, hide food for storage so that they can spatially map it, you know where to go back to. Anyway, go back to the London taxi driver. She decided that she wanted to do sort of a similar study in humans. So basically she compared the brains of London taxi drivers with the brains of London bus drivers. So the difference being that London bus drivers just go around the same route every single day, whereas London taxi drivers have to learn an incredible amount of maps. They really have to, you know, they train for years and they have to go around it. Anyway, the hippocampi, because you have two of them, so that's the Latin and the plural, the hippocampi in London taxi drivers is bigger than those in London bus drivers. And she went on to do a whole load of...
bus drivers have routes.
They just have routes that they follow, where the taxi drivers actually, you know, they're challenging their brain. They have to keep learning those routes and keep using them.
So I'm just thinking there about the London taxi drivers. So I've been using a smartphone since 2011.
Yeah.
And I've forgotten what it's like to have to remember things.
Yeah.
Because I have Google.
Yeah.
So even if I see... Jesus, because I was recounting a situation when I was about 20 and I was in a nightclub and I didn't have a smartphone, and I heard a song that I loved, or I'd heard a song that I loved and I'd heard it for the first time, and I remember having to write it down on my hand and then shielding my hand for the rest of the night because I would never hear that song again.
Yeah.
There was no way to Google, there was nothing, there was no Shazam. Yeah. And it was alien to me to think that I had to do something like that, because now... I'd have just pressed the button on my phone. It would have identified the song. Wouldn't have to worry about it. And I've been living my life like this for quite some time now, for over a decade, where basically it's like, I don't have to remember that. My phone will do it.
Yeah.
I don't have to recall that phone. I used to remember phone numbers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I used to remember my bank account numbers.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm a lot older than you. So like, I lived a longer life, you know, with none of those.
That's like 12 digits.
Yeah. You knew everything. You knew everybody's phone number. You knew your bank account details, loads of those numbers. And in fact, older people are better at remembering those things than younger people are now.
So what's that doing to our collective neuroplasticity?
So that's not impacting. What that's doing is, and I often get actually asked this question, you know. So basically, as regards the use of devices, I mean, I outsource my memory all the time, okay?
Is that what you call it, outsourcing
memory? I call it outsourcing memory.
Wow.
It's a piece of advice I actually give to people if they're feeling overloaded, or brain fog. A lot of people are feeling a lot of brain fog during the pandemic. I say, look, outsource your memory to your devices. You know, the minute someone makes an appointment, you know, the minute you said to me, you know, we'll do 2 o'clock or whatever, I put it straight into my diary because then I don't have to remember it. So here's the thing. There is no problem with outsourcing your memory to devices, provided you use the resources that you have freed up in your brain to do something else, to learn new things, to okay. be creative, to do whatever. So basically what you want to do to have a really healthy brain and to optimize your brain performance is harness this neuroplasticity, okay? Mm-hmm. Bigger is better when it comes to your brain. And I mean, really in important ways, say even in later life, if you were to get a disease, the pathology in your brain of something like dementia, Alzheimer's mm-hmm. disease, the more healthy brain you have, the longer you can resist the impact of that disease on your brain. So the longer you can hold on to your cognitive functioning before the symptoms that you associate with dementia appear. So you want as many connections in your brain. You know, actually, if you're over the age of 30, your brain starts to shrink through mm-hmm. a process called atrophy. So you lose a little bit of brain volume every year. And then by the age of 60, that starts to accelerate. So if mm-hmm. your brain shrinks, your cognitive capacity, the ability of your brain to do all the things you want to do, will suffer as well.
But now, can we fight this?
Yes, we can.
Okay.
Oh, I sounded like Obama there. Yes, we can. Yeah, we can. And that's what makes me so excited and passionate about what I do and about trying to tell people that. So yes, you can counteract that atrophy if you engage in things that promote brain health. So one of those is harnessing neuroplasticity. And that's why constantly learning things is absolutely brilliant for your brain. Now, everybody tends to think when you say learning, they think about academic learning mm-hmm. and learning as a sort of something that you had to do in school that was awful. That's not the kind of learning I'm talking about. Although if you want to do academic learning, yeah. that's perfectly fine. But it can be learning anything, you know, musical instrument, how to turn wood, the lyrics of a song, you mm-hmm. know, just learning anything, knitting, doesn't matter.
I find from that passion is really important with that. So from my experience, if I'm passionate about something, I'll consolidate that to my memory.
Yeah. So actually, that passion that you're talking about, and I did a podcast episode on this because I am absolutely passionate about what you're talking about, which is really curiosity. So in that case,
okay. yeah.
right? So it means something that you are intrinsically curious about, something that you just have a natural curiosity for. Learning is enhanced for that. So neuroplasticity is actually enhanced when you're naturally curious about something. So when you're naturally curious about, as you just said there, it's so easy to learn. You actually yeah. don't even have to put any effort into it. Okay.
It's just fun. It's not even learning.
It's just fun. And well, it is learning because your brain is actually growing those new connections. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, that's really exciting. And I said that in my podcast, teachers take bloody note. The thing is, if you are naturally curious about something, the learning is enhanced. And then if you stop doing the thing that you're curious about and turn your attention to something that maybe you're less curious about, that enhanced learning continues for a period.
Oh, wow.
So like, I think teachers should, you know, let kids explore whatever they're curious about for 10, 15 minutes and then teach them their theorems. Do you know what I mean? Like
yeah.
harness, like we do an awful lot of stuff to suit a regular society instead of actually understanding how our brains work and then, you know, harnessing or capitalizing that. Like teenagers are a prime kind of example of society kind of trying to push square pegs into round holes. When you're mm-hmm. a teenager, from puberty, your brain goes through a second period of incredible development. So the first period is from about the age of 2 to 7. So from puberty to up to about the age of 25, your brain is actually almost completely remodeled. Neuroplasticity is enhanced. It's a brilliant time to learn new stuff. That's why sort of academic stuff does work okay at that period of time.
Yeah.
But it actually, it's remodeled from the back to the front, and the front part of the brain is the latest to develop. And that's why teens are very vulnerable to taking risk. They're vulnerable to mental health issues because they engage in the world from more from their emotional brain, which is unthinking and reflexive rather than reflective. So teens need a lot of minding, really. And I think teens need a lot more parenting than we're doing at the moment, because their brain is incomplete and because they can't think rationally. And also the brain, while it's going through this period, doesn't actually learn from mistakes. It doesn't learn from negative experiences. So people will continue to make those same mistakes. So they need kind of guidance and support. Well, what I wanted to say there is our natural rhythms, our circadian rhythms, you know, when we're naturally awake, is also related to when we're most alert and when we can better learn, when we can take new information in, etc. So the teen brain is alert at different times to, say, the brain of someone like me who's in her 50s now. So basically, teens actually, they're wide awake in the evening time, you know, and you know, kind of afternoon is when they're sharpest. And, you know, most teens want to stay up late and their parents are telling them to go to bed because they've got to get up for school in the morning. The thing is, the teenage brain is should be sleeping first thing in the morning, and school really shouldn't start till kind of about 11 o'clock.
Wow.
Do you know, if you were to actually harness their natural rhythms, so you're kind of forcing their brain to do stuff when it's not the right time for that brain to be doing it.
And school hours probably exist just to accommodate capitalism.
Just because to accommodate, pretty much everything.
Parents are going to work.
Yeah, it's just to accommodate a society rather than actually to kind of work with our natural rhythms. And you got to understand, these things were set up before we really understood how the brain works. Like, it's really only in the last 30 years or so that we actually have the technology to understand a functioning brain. So, like, there's MRI, functional MRI scanners, the electrophysiology that I did, diffusion tensor imaging. These can all see the brain while it's actually engaging in activities. And when I say see the brain, you know, they can, you know, people, physicists and all those really, really smart people can, you know, they can make pictures and maps from the electrical signals. So you can kind of see which parts of the brain are firing when you engage in different activities. Like, you even have things like place cells, which are fascinating. They only fire when you're in a particular part of the room. Like, it's just...
What?
Yeah. Google it, folks, right? If you Google, there's videos online of place cells, and literally they're particular cells that fire when you go to a particular part of the room.
What are the parameters of this part of the room that makes the brain do this? Is it your personal relationship with that part of the room?
It's, you know, and then the brain really is just all about patterns. That's why, you know, routine is critical for mental health. It really is. The brain loves patterns, and it functions really well when you have regular routines. There's kind of a fine line between, so a lot of people with, you know, when they're giving advice about mental health will say, you know, we're living too much of our lives on autopilot and we need to be more present in the moment. And that is really true. Present mindedness is absolutely a brilliant way to keep anxiety and depression at bay, because anxiety and depression.
And why is that? Why is that?
Well, anxiety and depression, number one, are all about imagining futures that might happen, or, you know, ruminating over things that happened in the past.
Yeah.
If you're present in the moment, you can't do that.
Yeah.
And, again, a lot of people talk about present mindedness and mindfulness and all that sort of thing. Personally, I've always struggled to meditate and do that sort of thing. My brain is just like crazy on fire all the time. However, that's not the only way you can be present minded. It's not the only form of meditation, you know, that thing that, you know, where people sit and breathe. if you, like you said there, say when you're passionate about something, or, you know, maybe your music, you know.
You're talking about creative flow.
It's when you're, yeah, when you're in the flow, when you're lost. Yes. So what I say to people is find something that you absolutely love, something that you have fun doing, where if somebody was, you can lose hours, do you know?
When yeah.
You don't know what time, you can even miss lunch. Do you know that kind of way? Because you're
I need to ask you about that, right? Because that's a huge part of my job and my life is... Yeah.
So, and aren't you lucky? Because that's really, really brilliant for you.
I swear to God, it's the dragon that I chase. It's the meaning of my life, and what determines my happiness is the creative flow.
Yeah.
And that's whether I'm writing my books or making music or whatever. But like, especially when I'm writing a short story,
right?
I could literally spend 4 hours and I feel as if I've left the country. I'm just not present.
But you have. That's a lovely description, because that's what I'm trying to say to people is,
but
you know,
what is that like? What, look,
two things. Well, like, particularly during lockdown, a lot of people are stuck, even if they love people, you know, like a lot of the people we love, you kind of might spend a couple of hours every evening with them and the weekends. And now you're 24/7 with them. Anybody is irritating after that period of time. And what I say to people is, look, you always have this room in your head. It's a room that nobody else can go into, and you can lose yourself in there. And I really believe this kind of sounds a bit like an oxymoron. You've got to lose yourself to find yourself. That's what I think you have found. You're blessed. You find yourself when you're in that flow. I'm very fortunate. I love what I do, you know, and even when I'm talking like something like this or giving my talks, I'm in my flow. Do you know what I mean? I can't think of anything else. And my brain is, you know, just making connections and really enjoying it. So the really interesting thing about this is, so, you know, the way you sort of said you're chasing that dragon, you know, you're chasing, you know, to find that. Actually, sometimes if you stop chasing it, you'll find it much easier. So the reason.
Oh, yeah.
The reason I'll say that is, OK, so we're kind of a bit, how would I put it? And this is kind of hard to use language because it's kind of complex in that we think we exist independent of our brain, in you know, that's the illusion the brain kind of creates. But the brain, actually, you are your brain. That's it, full stop. It creates you.
Wow.
From lots of different information, from your own thinking, from what other people have said to you over the years, from
what's consciousness within all of that?
Yeah, so I think consciousness is our thinking. It is our awareness of who we are or who we think we are. It is the stories that we tell ourselves, I think. Consciousness, you see, the thing is, essentially, we kind of have three brains. Now, they're interconnected, but they're frequently described as three brains because they evolved, you know, over millions of years. So the first part of our brain to evolve was the reptilian brain. It's the brain stem. So that's the part of the brain that keeps you alive. So the brain stem is the evolutionary, the oldest part of the brain, and it is unconscious, and it carries out all of the activities that keep us alive. Okay.
So breathing and stuff.
Breathing, heart rate, digestion, all of those things, right? So if you have an injury to your brain stem, you're dead pretty much, unless you have access to a life support machine. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's critical. Now that's down at the stem. It actually connects to your spinal cord. Okay. Mm-hmm. I can put an image of this up if people want afterwards on my social media or whatever. But then the next part of the brain to evolve is what we call the limbic brain or the limbic system, and what most people will refer to as the emotional brain. So that's what you're talking about. That's where your amygdala is. That's where the center of your fear response and your emotions are. And it is also unthinking, unconscious, reflexive for a lot of the things, right? Particularly the amygdala is reflexive. Then on top of that, so to see that limbic part of the brain, you'd actually have to turn the brain upside down. Okay. It's inside. So then wrapped around that on the top is the crinkly part of the brain that most of us are used to thinking about when we think of a brain, that horrible beige crinkly bit. Yeah. And actually, I'd say to your listeners, Google Brainbow. Okay, like rainbow, but brainbow. And you will see some amazing images of the human brain from the cell perspective. They are like Monet paintings. They are wow. really beautiful. And what they are is proteins used, different color dyes used to show different brain cells. And that's what I'd prefer people to think about when they think about the brain, rather than that crinkly beige mass, because that just like looks sort of dead. Well, it is. You know, it only looks like that because it's been preserved in formaldehyde. But that crinkly part of your brain, that's the most recent to evolve. That is the thinking part of your brain. That is involved in language, vision processing, movement, you know, conscious movement, decision making, planning, organizing, all those things that make us human. And the very front part of that, the frontal lobes, is the most complex part. It was the very last to evolve. It's the last part to develop. So in the teenage brain, it's the part that can assess risk. It's kind of connected
critical thinking
to every other critical thinking. It's connected to every other part of your brain. So we call it the executive controller because it kind of has oversight of everything. So say, for example, if you talk about that fight or flight. So if you...
So we say anxiety. That's what I want to know.
So anxiety comes from stress. So I'm going to... So do you mind if I just sort of start at the beginning?
Go for
it. You know, with the stress bit, and then that will explain sort of the anxiety. So basically, you hear a loud bang, okay?
Yeah.
And without thinking, you'll either jump, scream, drop to the ground, depending or whatever. You know, it's a noise. And you just have this... reflexive response. Okay, now that noise or whatever the threat is, the information, the sensory information, so the sound, visual if it is visual, whatever, smell if it's the smell of something burning, you know, that sensory information comes into your amygdala, the fear center, via two routes, a short route and a long route. Okay, so the first goes directly to your amygdala, the unthinking part of your brain, so that you can jump out of the way or whatever of an oncoming car. It just saves your life. That's it. You know, you don't have time to think about saving your life. Like, just do it. And literally, that's what the amygdala does. So then the slower route, the longer route, it eventually goes to the amygdala, but it goes via the frontal lobes, the critical thinking part of your brain.
Yeah.
And that part of your brain, as I said, has connections to all the rest of your brain and actually all of the other relevant information. And it then sends a message to the amygdala, which is either, look, you know what? Shut off that stress response. It was only a car backfiring. There's nothing to worry about. We need to, you know, stop the release of cortisol. And the brain has a fabulous feedback loop that does that. We'll shut off the cortisol response and you can gradually bring your heart rate down.
What's the cortisol business?
Yeah, so that's sorry, I should explain that. So once the stress response is kicked off by any sort of threat, and actually I should explain that threat doesn't even have to be real. It can be imagined. So you could be worrying about something and it will kick off this same neurophysiological stress response. So it starts in your brain and basically sends messages to your adrenal glands to release adrenaline, and then for cortisol, which is the main stress hormone to be released. Now you need cortisol. It isn't just released when you are in a stressful situation. Cortisol is released first thing in the morning to wake up. When you wake up, it's the hormone that actually allows you kind of get up out of bed after slumber. So, you know, cortisol receptors all over your body. So, you know, it's useful. It's not like a bad thing. And it's not a bad thing anyway, because you need it. You need it to escape a mug or whatever. Yeah. So the cortisol is released. And basically what happens is unessential functions in your body are sort of shut down. So things like your immune response, your digestion.
Yeah.
So that everything can go into. So your heart rate will speed up. Yeah. Your lungs will expand so you can take in more oxygen. You'll start to sweat or whatever. But basically, you know, glucose will be produced into your limbs so that you can run or fight, whatever. So everything is, and you go into high alert, you know, like your senses become heightened. And it's a life preserving thing. So basically, if there's no need for it, then your thinking brain says, you know, shut this off. And, you know, it's got this lovely system where it can shut it down, or it can say, actually, no, that was a gun. Right. Stay down on the ground, look around, see if there's, you know, whatever. And we'll get you through that situation. And interestingly, memory in the hippocampus is enhanced when you have an acute stress response. Now, where this becomes problematic and where it can ultimately lead to anxiety is when stress becomes chronic.
Yeah.
And a lot of us have been living through chronic stress during the pandemic. You know, aside from just the fear of catching the virus, all the other stressors that have been increased, you know, stress.
The sheer uncertainty.
So uncertainty is, you know, fundamental to anxiety. It really is. And, you know, it's related to control. So, you know, the perception of stress occurs when we feel we don't have the capacity to cope with the challenge that we are facing, right? So basically, when stress becomes chronic, what happens is over time, neuroplasticity is increased in your amygdala, okay? So your fear response becomes enhanced. Your amygdala actually gets bigger. It is, unfortunately, decreased in your hippocampus. So your ability to learn and remember are decreased and your hippocampus starts to shrink. It is also decreased in your frontal lobes. So your ability to think critically and reflectively are reduced. And so over time, then, you are acting in a constant state of threat. You are on high alert. You see threat even where there isn't any.
Yeah.
Your emotional brain is just ruling the roost. So instead of your thinking brain calming down your emotional brain, if it's fired off, your emotional brain is pretty much shutting up your thinking brain. And then if that persists very long, you know, that can become sort of a full blown anxiety where, you know, your whole life is really ruled by your anxious thinking and your perceptions of threat. And on top of that, stress and sleep are inextricably linked. They have they both interfere with each other in that when you're critically stressed or chronically stressed, you have too much cortisol. And
you get night terrors and shit. Night terrors.
Just go everything going round and round and round. Yeah. And, you know, when it happens to me, I can feel it in my fingertips.
Yes.
And, you know, I feel like I've too much energy in my legs, you know. Basically, my body is ready to go running somewhere and I can't sleep. And so the less sleep you have, the more susceptible you are to stress. And the more stress you have, the less sleep you have.
Toxic feedback loop all around.
It's a toxic feedback loop. And the thing is, though, as well, what's really interesting is that not everybody is. So that stress sleep relationship isn't equal across all individuals. So there's a thing called sleep reactivity. Mm-hmm. And that just refers to how much stress impairs your sleep, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you have high sleep reactivity, that means that when you're stressed, your sleep is going to be disrupted. And then someone with low stress reactivity, like my husband, even if the things were falling down around him, he can sleep. It doesn't impact on his ability to sleep. It doesn't mean that he isn't stressed when he is awake, but it doesn't impact on his ability to sleep. Now, women are more susceptible to, are more likely to have high sleep reactivity. People who have a family history of insomnia are also more likely to have high sleep reactivity. And there does seem to be some sort of genetic element as well. And then people who have high sleep reactivity are also more likely to be diagnosed with anxiety and depression.
Wow.
So, and then also more likely to go on to develop insomnia disorder. So that's why one of the things in both my books, I have full chapters on sleep and why you need sleep and why your brain needs sleep and why it is critical for it to be one of the things that you prioritize in your life. You know, if you care about your mental health, you've really got to work on getting sufficient high quality sleep every night. It will, you know, if you, and I mean, I know that sounds like saying, yeah, but I can't sleep, but it really is about investing time and working on getting to a place where you can sleep. It's not going to be an easy journey, but there's tons of different things that you can do.
Like I found that phones, Sabina, like since I've had a smartphone, I haven't been getting the sleep I used to get. Simply having a phone that I look into before bed excites me too much.
No, stop it. Stop it instantly, right? There's simple rituals, really.
Is that a straight up red flag for bad
sleep? That's a straight up red flag for bad sleep. And the reason it's a red flag, so you're saying it you know, stimulates you, the stuff that you're looking at. But actually, it's the blue, that's part of it. But the main thing is the blue light that comes out of your phone. It suppresses melatonin, which is a chemical in your brain that kind of calls you to sleep. So essentially, if you're looking at a blue light before you go to bed, your brain thinks it's daytime.
Okay.
And it's not getting the message that it should go asleep. So look, there's no data to say when you should, you know, what's the exact time you should stop using your blue light. But what I say to people is, look, switch off any blue light emitting devices for an hour before your bedtime.
Wow.
Right.
And Camille, I've heard that there's a relationship between poor quality sleep when you're younger and then developing things like Alzheimer's and dementia when you're older. Is that true?
Yeah, there's a huge relationship between sleep and dementia. We don't know which way it goes around, but poor sleep is critical for learning and memory. Okay. So when you take information in during the day, it goes into a temporary repository, the hippocampus, right? And that has limited resources. So that's why when you get towards the end of the day and someone starts telling you something, you say, sorry, can't take anything in. Tell me tomorrow, I need to go sleep. It's full, basically, okay? So when you go to sleep, so you basically cycle through 5 90-minute cycles if you're getting, you know, a full night's sleep.
Yeah.
And through each of those cycles, you have non-REM sleep and REM sleep, but of different proportions in each cycle. So at the start of the night, you've more non-REM sleep than REM sleep. But by the time you get to your last cycle, you've much more REM sleep than non-REM sleep. So that's your dream sleep. So that's when you're doing most of your dreaming. So at the start of the night, we see electrical activity between the hippocampus and the frontal lobes that I talked to you about, the executive controller. And what we believe is happening there is that your frontal lobes are filtering the information that you took in during the day. And they're saying, dump that. Oh, yeah, we need to make that a memory. Dump that, keep that, right? Because we can't keep everything that we take in. Your brain has a limited capacity. So then a little bit later in the night, we see... I'm making hand movements here because you can't see me. But basically, you know, you don't have a place in your brain where memories are stored. They're stored in electrical patterns. OK,
wow.
So those patterns, we see patterns of electrical activity going across various areas of your brain. And that's that new information starting to be made, consolidated into a memory. And actually, one little tip, if you want to really make sure that you remember stuff, engage as many senses as you possibly can. That's something that's beaten out of us when we go to school. If you look at any toddler, they explore the world with every sense.
Yeah.
They taste stuff, they touch it, they roll in it, you know, they smell it, they do everything. And then they go to school and they're told, law of attraction, you know, cross your hands, sit down, sit still and just listen. And so you're minimizing, you know, it's a very, like the more senses you engage when you're living in the world makes it richer, but it also enriches the memory. And so then when that's been sort of bedded down in your brain at night, it's been bedded across various different senses. And so actually, even if you go on in later life to develop something like dementia and your language centers are damaged and not functioning, you still have access to those memories via your sensory other senses, you know. So it's really important. I really encourage people to engage. And also it makes your life richer anyway.
So one little question I'm going to ask before I get back to the other part was, so I get asked so much about sleep hygiene. It's my listeners to my podcast, it's one thing they're very concerned about because everyone's using their phone. And I think most people are aware that the phone is what's messing with their sleep. Now, I've been doing this for nearly 10 years, so that's now, I'm concerned, we'll say. Have I done damage to my brain, or can I, if I improve my sleep hygiene now, can I?
Can I fix it? Yeah, of course. The brain is really resilient. So it has this other capacity as well called, I like to describe it like, if you adopt a brain healthy lifestyle, it's like investing in brain capital that you can cash in at some point in the future to cope with or compensate for challenges in life. And that challenge could be something like COVID and the pandemic. It could be aging. It could be a brain injury, or it could be a disease like dementia in later life, or a disease like multiple sclerosis that hits people in earlier life. Right. And so what we know from research is that that resilience. So some people can have Alzheimer's disease, but not have the symptoms. They are resilient to the disease. Wow. And that resilience is linked to lifestyle factors. Okay, so they're the pillars of what. So you know, my books are about brain health and about beating brain fog and the fundamental principles of brain health. You know, getting good quality sleep is a primary, is one of the key ones. So it is critical. It is important that people are worried about it, because at least that might spur them to take action. The World Health Organization has declared long before the pandemic a sleep loss epidemic, with one in three people not getting enough sleep. And actually, since the pandemic, apparently there's been a 20% rise in the prescription of sleeping tablets, which is not something that's a great idea, because
Do you think that's because of increased anxiety or just people being lethargic because they're not moving?
I think it's a combination of things, to be perfectly honest. Yes, I think stress, the chronic stress, is going to impair sleep. I think the loss of routine is going to interfere with that. I think if people have lost jobs, understimulation is going to interfere with that. Exercise or lack of exercise is going to interfere with that. So it's going to be multiple factors. But most of the brain healthy stuff kind of covers everything. But if you go back to the sleep thing, so light is absolutely, managing your exposure to light is a critical way to improve your sleep. So the minute you wake in the morning, open your shutters or curtains or whatever you have. If it's the winter time in Ireland and it's dark, turn on a white light, okay? Mm-hmm. Not a blue light. Don't open your laptop or whatever. So you've got to understand, our brain evolved over millions of years. We only have electric light for a couple of hundred years. Yeah. And we only have these devices for like... So our brain is looking for signals from light to get a proper sleep routine. So I'm saying to people as well, and this might be something to do with the pandemic as well and the disruption of sleep, is that people are working from home and some people aren't leaving their homes at all. So you need to get out in daylight. I say to people a minimum of half an hour, but like, you know, more if you can, okay? And then in the evening time, you got to take control of the electrical light in your house. So I would suggest that from about 8 o'clock in the evening, dim your lights. If you have a dimmer switch, or, you know, put on lamps, turn off the overhead light. If you're on a budget, like I picked up a couple of lamps in Dunn's the other day for €10, you know, mm-hmm. they don't, you know, it's not going to break the bank. It really isn't. But it will really improve your sleep if you start to lower those
candles.
Lights.
Candles are lovely.
They're also really relaxing if you... you know, have a nice one that's a calming smell. So that's another thing then. And then when you go to bed, you got to make sure that your room is really as dark as it possibly can be. So another thing that I suggest to people is often one of the last things that people do before they go to bed is brush their teeth. They're tired. You go up the stairs, they turn out the bright light in the bathroom and brush their teeth and wake up the brain. So what I say to people is, look, so kind of in my new book, I have like a whole week, you know, that's just devoted to sleep rituals that you can gently introduce into your life to help you sleep well. And one of the suggestions I say is you start a wind down routine from about an hour before bed. Okay, so put the devices away, go upstairs, get into your PJs, your comfies or whatever, and brush your teeth then. Okay.
Yeah.
You're done. Don't eat anything after that anyway. It's not good. Eating late at night will upset your sleep as well. Then come back downstairs. As you said, light your candles or you have your lower light or whatever. Listen to relaxing music. Read a paperback book. Do you know what I mean?
Or that's important. Literally, that's a huge thing I've been doing. Going back to an actual physical book rather than my Kindle or reading a book on my laptop.
Yeah.
A piece of paper.
Or have a bath or, you know, indulge yourself by putting some cream on yourself just look, think about it. If you have children and you're trying to induce a routine, you know, you calm them down. You don't take them from running wild around the house and say, now go to bed. Mm-hmm. You have a wind down routine for the child. And sometimes that involves having a bath.
Yeah.
Do you know, whatever. So really make that eye. And it's nice. It's nice to take time out to just do some of that nice sort of restorative stuff. It helps calm everything down a bit. Another thing that's really important that a lot of people aren't aware of. So temperature is almost as important or as important as light when it comes to getting good sleep. So given the kind of climate we live in, you know, a lot of people will turn the heat on in the bedroom before they go up, or they may even have electric blankets, and I want to be nice and cozy in my bed, and you know, they want to make the room really warm. Actually, you need to turn your heat off from about an hour before you go to bed.
And Sabina, what about, like, we're mentioning phones there and the light, but also most of us, when we're on our phone, we're looking at social media.
So that's
social media is all about high arousal emotions, whether it's making you angry or anxious or whatever.
So cut that out. And similarly, so a lot of people will say, you know, oh God, I'm so wrecked after work, or I'm so stressed, can't wait to go home. When we even used to go, you know, when we had a workplace to go to or whatever.
Yeah.
Can't wait to go home and watch Netflix and chill. Now, the research shows that even just 2 hours watching Netflix or some other show or program or whatever actually increases anxiety and depression rather than reduces them. And just think of the nature of the stuff you're watching.
Exactly.
Obviously, you could choose carefully. Like, so I would tend to, if I don't watch very much television at all, to be perfectly honest, but if I did, and if I did watch a switch off, I'll watch things that kind of give me comfort, maybe like homes being decorated or, you know, because I kind of like that stuff.
Or listen to a nice podcast.
Are brilliant. I talk about them, you know, in my book. And they're a great way to send you sleep as well. I know that sounds awful, but I have fallen asleep while listening to a podcast.
Oh, Jesus. I get people listening to a full 8 hours of my podcast and they're not even awake.
Yeah, but that's good. You know, if it kind of, you know, if it kind of gets you asleep. But the temperature thing is, your core body temperature has to drop by 1 degree before you can actually go into sleep. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a hot room, you've no chance of that happening. So really, you want to be thinking of a cool room. And one way to do that is actually counterintuitively to have a hot bath.
Okay.
Because when you step out of a hot bath into the cool air of the bathroom, the heat is drawn from your core to your extremities to heat them up. So that actually will reduce your core temperature, because it's your core temperature you want to reduce before you go to sleep. So that's kind of another sort of tip that people aren't aware of. Exercise is a brilliant way to boost sleep, but not near bedtime. Absolutely nowhere near bedtime. It's critical.
There's one thing I wanted. So just to take it back to something you were speaking about earlier. So when you were speaking about the amygdala and the emotional part of the brain, and how when we're stressed, how the emotional part of the brain can take over.
Yes.
So when I was like 19, 20, I had pretty bad anxiety, which then developed into agoraphobia. So I was
living
in my room for like a year. And
oh my God.
The thought of like being in like a pub or a supermarket.
Yeah.
It was just like not a hope. I'm going to get an anxiety attack.
Yeah.
But I don't live that, like, that's a distant memory.
Yeah.
I went to psychotherapy, but also what was very important for me, cognitive behavioral therapy, and how I used it myself to challenge my beliefs and change my behavior, and then to basically become a person who's mentally healthy and doesn't exist with unhealthy anxiety. Can you explain? So that took me about a year.
Yeah.
And the most important thing for me was whatever about changing my beliefs about, you know, the supermarket isn't going to give me anxiety. It was when I actually went and changed my behavior and started going to the supermarket and gradually exposing myself that's when I truly felt change.
Yeah.
Now, for me, that was all very abstract, because I'm looking at it from a psychology point of view. I'm not thinking about my brain.
Yeah.
But can you tell me, as a neuroscientist, what's happening there in the physical brain?
Yeah, so basically your brain really operates on patterns, okay? And that's what our behaviors are, you know, and that's actually who we are. We are patterns of behavior, you know, and when they change, we change. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So so does your brain. So kind of to explain a little bit, I have to explain that your brain, it only weighs 2% of your body, right? But it consumes about 25% of the oxygen and nutrients that you take in, that's circulating at any one time. That's your brain's fuel, okay?
Yeah.
Now, It's the thinking part of your brain, the crinkly part, the part that develops last, is the highest consumer of brain fuel. Okay?
Yeah.
So anything, and you know it yourself, engaging in any of those activities that require you to solve problems, to think critically.
You'd be starving.
And we must go back to your creativity, because I do want to answer that. Yeah, so it really uses a lot of resources. So your brain, in order to be efficient and effective, constantly scans your behaviours for patterns that it can automate.
Oh, wow, to save energy.
Yeah, to save energy.
Holy fuck.
Yeah, so wow. It automates behaviour and hands over responsibility for those patterns of behaviour to your emotional brain, to a part of it called the basal ganglia. Okay, and so basically then your thinking brain, it just it does, it's like a bookend. It kind of checks it, you know, checks in at the beginning. Yeah, that's that behavior. Basal ganglia will do it. And it checks in at the end. Yeah, that worked fine. Okay, so basically pre-pandemic, 40% of our behaviors were automated. They were our habits. For most people, you know, it could be, say they get up at 7 a.m., it could be 10 a.m. before they actually consciously, you know, really engage in a thinking behavior, because they get up, they pee, they brush their teeth, shower, breakfast, commute, whatever. It's all pretty much done on autopilot. Now, a lot of people, when they're talking about mental health, say we live too much of our lives on autopilot. That's probably true, but it is essential that we live some of our lives on autopilot, and about 40% is pretty good. And that allows you to use your brain for those other more complex activities, for your writing, your music, or whatever. Yeah. So you need routine and habits. That's one of the reasons people have been feeling really stressed, or their brain fog, they just feel they're not working possibly properly, is that like a year ago, just one day, everybody was told to go home and figure out how to work. And people just dropped all of their routines. And most people didn't engage in any regular behavior. So they might get up at 10 o'clock today, 7 o'clock tomorrow. They might homeschool for an hour first thing in the morning. And
so that's
might...
exhausting.
So that's exhausting. And your brain can't see any patterns to automate. It can't fix the problem.
Why am I tired and I'm not leaving the house?
Why am I tired when I'm doing less than I used to do? Well, you're tired because you are not engaging in routines. So the solution is simple. Just reintroduce all your routines. And I'm saying to people, introduce a fake commute, because it's really important to bookend that work, you know, to separate work from home in some sort of way. So that's a really, really sort of simple solution. So now going back to the patterns. So you have patterns of thinking, okay?
Yeah.
But they're like those habits. They were just habits. So something would trigger and you'd go down that thinking, you know, oh, I can't leave the house because of this. Oh, yeah. I can't do this because of that.
And then before you know it, I literally am trapped in my room.
But you're trapped in a behavior. So what I think is really liberating about that is you go, OK, so that means I need to just I need to create a new habit of thinking. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, creating a new habit is effortful. Because you have to actively. So even if you're talking about something like, you know, you want to stop, say you eat chocolate after lunch every day.
Yeah.
Okay. It's probably been an automated thing. You just reach for the bar of chocolate, or you go down to the shop and buy the bar of chocolate, whatever, after lunch. And it's unthinking and habit. So to break that, you have to very actively resist that chocolate, not go, or replace what you do then with something else that's not eating the chocolate, like going for a run or whatever. And that's going to be really hard, but only for a certain period of time. Now, that period of time, on average, you know, it really just depends on the activity. If it's a simple thing that you haven't been doing for very long, you know, you can swap it out and put in a new habit relatively quickly. If it's something that's been ingrained for years, it's going to take more work and longer. But basically, what you've got to do is actively engage your thinking brain, that frontal lobes, and you've got to inhibit your behavior actively, you know, and say, don't eat that chocolate.
What I'd like to raise with you there, right? So I I did that via CBT.
Yes, exactly.
I'm so also conscious of the fact that worked for me, and yes, it was difficult, but there are people who would have what would be described as, we say, personality disorders or things like that, where CBT failed them.
Yes.
The ability to simply make choices and repattern and think rationally, it doesn't work for these people or people with trauma. Can you speak about that and what's going on with the brain there?
I think you're kind of moving into then a different realm when you talk about personality disorders, okay, etc. I'm talking about, I'm talking about sort of the human brain in a sense, in that is kind of, we'll say, for want of a better word, wired pretty much similarly. You know, going into those kind of things and schizophrenia, they're kind of a different realm, and in a way they're outside my remit, and I would kind of rather not
I get you.
But I'm very happy to go there with the trauma. But
what I would like to do is, could I ask a very basic question? Yeah. Okay, and you can choose to not answer it if it's not. If within that territory of mental illness or schizophrenia or personality disorders, is there evidence that the physical brain is different? Or even the pathways are different?
So so the thing is, there can be. But the thing is, what's really, it's our behaviours, our life experience that wire our brain, you know, that shape it. So
Are we a blank slate?
No, we're not a blank slate. And that's a very good way to describe it. So obviously we have, part of the brain that, the occipital lobes at the back of your brain, they're involved in processing visual information. You know, on the left side, you have where your language centers are, etc. So like you have your basic brain, so to speak, it's wired for all those kind of functions. But, like an infant needs to be stimulated, and between the ages of 2 and 7, the shaping of that brain will be influenced by the kind of stimulation or lack of stimulation that it has had. Because part of this, so say when we go to the teenage brain, so it's remodeled. So what actually happens is, parts of the brain that have, not parts of the brain, but neurons and connections that haven't been regularly used are pruned away. Okay? So there's growth and there's pruning. So it's really critical in those periods that you engage with the world and that you develop, like that you teach kids how to do various things or engage in various activities so that those neurons aren't pruned away, or that they are actually, that you're shaping and enhancing kind of ones that will serve them well. You mentioned trauma there.
Yeah, what does childhood trauma do to the brain, even into adulthood?
Yeah, it's very, very relevant in that if you've been exposed to trauma, your stress response may be disproportionate compared to someone who's not been exposed to trauma.
And what's the difference between trauma and a bit of a fright or something?
I think a bit of a fright is part of the learning curve of life. And I think that's why it's important as well that, people are exposed to experiences. I think it's mad sometimes, where people just put, you're an adult now, 18, out in the world. And actually, really, you need to learn about challenges and, bits of frights or taking risk in a safe way. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Because your body will learn how to cope with those, or what works or what doesn't, in a safe space. I think, a bit of a fright is, your body, your brain will learn about that fright, and it will remember that fright, and it will know that, okay, don't do that again because that's what will happen, or here's how you coped with that before. And it may be that you had somebody who helped you cope with that fright, helped you through it. With a trauma or a severe trauma, where you're talking about childhood abuse and those kind of things, and kids navigating a childhood where maybe where there's violence and they're learning to adapt their behavior so that they don't instigate, and I mean that in just the sense, like not saying that they're any responsibility for, for violence being, brought on them, but they're learning how to, they're making connections. Their brain is making connections and going, okay, when he hit mum that time, it was because I did such and such. Do you know?
Children have a way to blame themselves.
Yes, and that's where, that's where actually sort of inappropriate links are made. Your brain's not infallible. Mm-hmm. It looks for patterns, but particularly your emotional brain, it's not very good at distinguishing patterns. So it'll often make incorrect links.
Yeah.
Okay, so your thinking brain is very good at connecting patterns, but your emotional brain isn't necessarily. And so you can make these silly connections. Like, you know, if you take a simple example, like a goalkeeper, you know, maybe saved 6 penalties when he had his green socks on. You know, the green socks have nothing to do with that, but they will want to wear the green lucky socks or whatever, you know. So there's, we all do those kind of erroneous connections. When you have had trauma as a child, your stress response is going to be activated, you know, in a different way. And not, you know, it either you will have a stress response much sooner. You'll have it to, you know, things that maybe other people wouldn't. I mean, I know of people, actually even you have a relative who kind of grew up in, you know, kind of one of those institutions. Like, I speak very loudly because both of my parents were deaf, not totally deaf, but they had very, very poor hearing. And like, she always, she kind of actually literally kind of jump back from my voice and make me feel very guilty, you know. But that loud noise was kind of, you know, a bit of a trigger kind of for her. So everybody will be different. And I think also people who have been exposed to trauma most probably have post-traumatic stress disorder as well. So it's a disordering of the trauma. And the reverse can happen too, I believe, you know, where the stress response becomes suppressed, do you know, and they actually don't react, you know, to things that you would ordinarily expect someone to react to. I think these things can be worked on. And I think people, you know, who have those, you know, kind of issues would do very well to work with someone who specializes in trauma. So say you did CBT, I'm sure you did it with someone who, you know, really had a good understanding around anxiety. And I think it's important that if you suspect, you know, that your anxiety or whatever other issues that you may have are a consequence of trauma, that it is important to work with someone who understands that. That doesn't mean, and I also think it's very, I think it's, you know, for me, you know, that's why therapy, when you said CBT, for me, the only therapy that is of value is therapy that empowers you to change your life in positive ways. I do not approve of, and I'm quite happy to say this, therapy that creates dependence, where you need your therapist in order to survive, where you have a lifelong relationship with your therapist. To me, that's just making money out of you. It is not empowering you, you know. And I think a good therapist will, you know, acceptance and commitment therapy, you know, can be a very helpful form of therapy. You know, it's accepting, you know, the certain behaviors that you engage in, what you have to work on, and then committing to change them through very much what you're talking about, changing your thinking, changing your behaviors, and eventually your patterns in your brain will change. What's really important to note while I say that is, whilst you can replace old habits, you know, whilst you can introduce new, helpful, healthy habits, the old habits will never go away. Okay, they are always there. It is important
I have to
remember
to work on
that
this
they are
every
always
day.
There.
I always say that. I'm someone who used to have mental health issues, but and now I live my life as a mentally healthy person. But especially over the pandemic, old patterns have come back. Every single day, I got to work on it.
Yeah. Those old patterns are there. Now, it makes sense from a, you know, just a brain performance perspective. Like, say you have to wear, say you wore lace-up shoes to work before the pandemic, right? When you learn how to tie a lace as a child, it's really difficult. It's a really cognitively demanding activity, okay? It's resource heavy. But then you learn how to do it with habit, without thinking, okay? It would not make sense after this year that you would have to relearn how to tie your shoelaces. You might be a bit rusty, but the habit will just come back.
I'm scared of relearning small talk. Seriously, I've met so few strangers. Yeah. I haven't. Look, the only strangers I meet are in a shop. And when I'm in a shop, the anxiety is so high, I can't
people.
Hear them with the mask
you
on.
Poor thing.
So I'm literally, I'm worried about small talk, spontaneous small talk. And as well, I'm going to have to, like, it took a lot of work for me to become a person who can gig in front of 1,000 people. And I'm going to have to go back out and gig in front of 1,000 people.
But I think for the moment, There's no point in worrying about it. Like, worry serves no purpose
because it's not happening right now.
Deal with it because it's not happening right now. So kind of deal with it, you know.
And when the anxiety steps in, I underestimate my ability to cope. That's always the case because I know when it does happen, what I do say to myself is, fuck it, whatever happens, I can, the best I can expect of myself is to cope. I will cope.
Yes. So there's, just hit my mic. There's two things there. So just to say to people in terms of giving useful kind of practical, advice, the thing is that old habits are more likely to return if you have poor sleep or you're going through a chronically stressful period.
Wow.
So being alert to that is more important. And a lot of us have experienced that, you know. And the funny thing is, we stopped
change
all
bring
our...
Change that in, won't it? Change is often a big
trigger. Yes, yeah. Change is quite challenging, you know. But the thing is, you know, whilst we all dropped those habitual behaviours, the routines that we had during the day, most of us created new routines in the evening that weren't really very good for us. Like saying, it's 5 o'clock, I'm having a G&T, you know. And unfortunately, those habits, the brain is so desperate for patterns, it's scanning. And your brain does not make value judgments about your patterns of behaviour. It's just looking for
patterns. Do you know
why
I think that happened? Now, this is just a little theory that I have. When lockdown happened, the only behavioural context that we had for lockdown was the few days around Christmas.
That's it.
And what do you do at
Christmas?
I totally
agree with you.
That's when you're allowed
to
drink
and you stay up late
and eat a full tin of roses. But then it's like you're doing it for a month because it's like, sure, it's fucking Christmas. All the shops are closed.
Well, there you go. Great minds think alike. That's
is
my
it?
Personal theory on this as well. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I actually said, I do a good bit of radio and I actually said it on, well, it was Sean O'Rourke then, you know, that's what happened, you know. And I actually said, so I was on in the early days of the pandemic, giving advice on how people could cope with the stress. Because if you go back, like we've kind of adapted a bit. If you go back to those early days, everyone
terrifying.
Fucking Jesus. Okay. And they were eating up every piece of news.
And,
there's so many
people going buying too much toilet roll. But even speaking to people, I would speak to someone and they had genuine, true terror in their voice because there's a pandemic.
I wanted to talk to you about curiosity because you did ask me about that, about your
creative flow.
So I think sometimes... That's when I started into that sort of hard bit to talk about the consciousness, because I don't like to talk about the mind because I think it's unhelpful. I think it's an unnecessary middleman. Mm-hmm. It's too iffy. What is it? You know, I much prefer to just talk about the brain behavior, and that includes thinking as a behavior. But our sense of self, whatever that is, that's kind of consciousness really, is our sense of who we are. And it's just all the stories that we tell ourselves or the information that we've taken in from other people that, you know, build up to kind of who we are. That sense of self, we sort of give much more credit to that than it kind of deserves in a way. Okay. So when we want to solve a problem, or when you want to write a song or do something really creative or whatever, you work really, really hard to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, in a way, particularly when it comes to creativity and insight, you would be better trusting your brain a little more. So there's two things that you can do that will harness your brain's ability to be creative. One of them is sleep. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I got as far as sort of the middle of the night where the memories are being sort of embedded across networks in your brain. So when you go through the night towards the, you can say the later part of the night, or I kind of think of it early morning, you know, when you're having that dream sleep, REM sleep, that new information that you have taken in is connected to your previous memories, your previous experiences, all the other information that you have built up in your brain over the years. And that's kind of why you can have those mad dreams where it's a bit of something from today with something from your childhood or whatever, all kind of mixed together. Okay. Now, if you regularly get sufficient quantity of sleep, which for adults really is between 7 to 9 hours sleep a night, and sufficient quality, good quality sleep. So by that, I mean you go through those full five cycles. Yeah. Okay. You will then wake up with solutions. How many times have you kind of wrestled with a problem and then you get a good night's sleep and you wake up with the answer?
When I have, what happens is I wake up and it's as soon as I hit the shower, that's when it pops into my head.
Right, you get it. Okay, I frequently get it as soon as I wake up. So say when I'm writing my book, you know, I could be really struggling and I've learned now, I know now, I just stop. I stop and I say it. I give talks to loads of corporate companies and, you know, I gave one to architects, you know, and they're working to a deadline. And I say, stop, take a break, do something restorative, get a good night's sleep. You've put the problem into
feeding
your
brain. Feeding the unconscious, I call that.
Feed it. Yes, exactly. You feed the information into your brain and it will come out the next morning. You might need more than one night's sleep. You know, how many times does the idea come to you in the supermarket? Well, pre-pandemic, when you're not stressed, because stress is going to interfere with it. So your brain has the capacity. Your brain is bloody brilliant. Trust it a bit more. You don't have to always force it, but put the ideas in. Another time when it happens is when you're daydreaming. Yeah. Okay. So a lot of us are so busy all the time. We're always doing. Now, and I'm not very good at sitting, doing nothing. I really am, because that's where my slip into mental health issues occurs.
When you're not active. Not,
you know, I'm not active, right? I can start to ruminate. You know, I mentioned you off air and I've talked about it in my own podcast as well. My father had what was called manic depression back then, or it's bipolar now or whatever. So you, when you grow up with someone like that, and he was also suicidal throughout my whole teens, you're very aware of your own, you know, tendency towards a bit of depression or whatever, because you don't want to go that route. So I tend to, you know, be very wary of when and how I might get depressed. So that is what would happen to me if I kind of, and for me, the most challenging time was when I was raising my children. So I would have to be there to monitor and make sure they're safe, but I couldn't actively be doing something. And, you know, I had a blue chair that I would sit in and look out the garden and I would ruminate, you know, and I would get depressed because, like, is this it? Is this what it's all about? Is there, you know? And I remember doing a podcast. I think it's my very first podcast with Hilary Fannin. And we were just talking about, you know, that and motherhood and, you know, those kind of things. And she laughed. She said she had a red chair, you know, and it was just that thing of, you know, I need to be active and doing. And when you're raising kids, that can be quite quite difficult. And also you can't have, like, I need stimulating and challenging conversations and to be, and you don't have that with young kids. So that for me, but I'm kind of aware of that. But anyway, that was completely sidetracking. So daydreaming, what's really interesting is, again, when you look at the electrical activity in your brain, when you're daydreaming, and by daydreaming, I mean not actively engaged in something, not consciously actively engaged in something. So actually, in a way, it could be when you're, you know, kind of strolling along, you know, the street, or do you know what I mean? When you're not, and maybe for you, it's when that you're in the shower.
Well, what I try and do is I try and engage in activity that's that I would consider to be playful. So if I want to create...
Don't tell me what you're doing in the shower.
I mean, if I'm sitting down and I have to write a short story, we'll say, if I'm writing a book, and this has to be... What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to daydream. I'm trying to get into that daydream space where I'm not really controlling it, but I am. And that's where stories reveal themselves to me.
That's the flow.
And how I get into that space is... I know if I don't want to get into that space, then I start to think, what's a good idea? I don't do that. Sometimes I'll actually sit down and think of the worst, silliest idea possible and write my way out of it. I think back to when I was a kid. When I was a child and I used to play with Lego, I didn't care about whether what I was making was good. I didn't care what it was. I was simply engaged in the act of making Lego. Yeah. And then I would engage in that daydream state, which I now know as flow. So as an adult, that's what I do. I sit down at my laptop and I try and engage in play. And I don't judge whether what I'm doing is good or bad. I'm simply having fun. And once I'm there, I've left the room. And that's what I'd like to know. How can I spend 3 hours writing a story, then finish it and literally feel as if I didn't write this? Like I'm watching someone else's film. Like what happened in that space?
because you haven't, you have just let your brain flow, right? You've just let it produce without your dialogue on top of it, without your constant judgment of yourself. There's no dialogue. You are doing it. So it's that dialogue, and, you know, that thinking, that talking, that self-talk is at the root of most mental activity.
I'm going to ask you one last question before we go, because it was a question that was asked on Instagram, right? And I'd really like to know the answer. Epigenetic trauma or vestigial memory, like, can we inherit memories? Does the brain inherit memories? Like, why am I scared of spiders? I've never met a tarantula.
So definitely we have inherent fears, and some people have hyper fears. So if you go to 23andMe, yeah, you know, or one of those places, and you get your genome sequenced or whatever, they can tell you whether you are likely to have a fear of, wow, spiders, whether you are likely to you know, like I can't stand, oh God, what's that? Coriander. Yeah. I just hate the taste of it. They can tell you things like that based on your genomic profile. Now, I would have a huge... Did you say you have the fear of spiders? I have a horrible fear of spiders.
I'm not too bad. Like, I'm not... I'm okay with spiders, but like other people are scared of spiders, and we live in Ireland.
Yeah, there's a few yeah exactly, there's a few theories on it, but yeah, no, I look at a spider and my whole, yeah, like I literally get the hairs on the back of my neck stand up.
But you've never learned as an Irish person that this spider is a threat.
No, I never learned to fear of spiders. However, so there's always a combination, of, if you want to use that old thing, nature and nurture, but I actually think it's a combination of evolution. Yeah. So our brains have evolved, and so it makes sense, right? So ancestors of ours who had an instinctive fear, you know, who were more fearful of spiders, maybe responded more quickly. And so therefore the ones who didn't, yeah, died out because they got killed by the spiders, mm-hmm, you know what I mean, or whatever. So there's that bit. There is your, there's sort of your genetic history, you know, from your particular family. And there's your lived experience, you know, and your learned experience, and that shapes all of those. And like, people think that genes are your genes, but genes are switched on and, wow, switched off by experiences. Wow. So, you know, I could have the same genetic profile as a twin sister, but if we've had different experiences, the expression of certain genes,
holy,
will be different.
Fuck.
I know in my book I wrote about, so there's things called, I can't remember the name of them. I nearly have to flick. Environmental factors, EDCs, okay. I was right, and endocrine disrupting compounds, okay? And so basically they can impact on various bodily symptoms and hormones. So when your brain communicates electrical and chemical signals, it uses neurotransmitters, yes, okay? They send messages. But hormones, so they are involved in sort of the immediate behaviors, but your hormones are also chemical messengers, but they influence... Their influence is wider and for longer. So they will influence sort of your overall mood rather than, you know, a particular physical, yeah, action, do you know? But you've hormones everywhere. You know, people tend to think of testosterone and estrogen as just being involved in reproduction, but they're involved in learning and memory and all sorts of things. You've loads of those receptors in your hippocampus that, mm-hmm, I was talking about earlier. But your endocrine system releases your hormones, but lots of these EDCs are found in things like soap and fire retardant chemicals, and they're around us, wow, you know, in things that we consume. They're even in makeup, etc., or in certain types of plastic and plastic bottles, okay? And they can disrupt your chemicals, okay? And they can impact and have changes on your chemicals, generally not in a very good way, okay? Now, one of the really things that I was interested in when I was researching this myself for my book is that influence can be passed on to a child,
wow,
but it can also then be passed on to future generations, which is kind of crazy. Which is mad. And those EDCs can actually interfere with your ability to manage stress. You know,
and these
so
are present
that's
in products
kind of
that we can purchase.
Oh, yeah. So Let me see. Yeah, so they, let me see, if just see a list here because I'm tired. You know, they can be in the soil that grows the food or the water that you bathe in, you know, things that you drink, things that you eat, antibacterial soap, some food stickers, some Teflon cooking, lots of stuff, right? But the thing is, actually, yeah, I mean, they can impact. So here's what I actually have. I have the page opened here around, and this is, I think, the epigenetics mm-hmm. that you're talking about. So EDCs are all around us. An exposed mother can biologically transfer EDCs to her baby through the placenta and breast milk. There's also evidence that EDCs can bring about changes in the cells that ultimately give rise to sperm and eggs. This means that the effects of EDCs can be passed through genes from parent to child, and future generations could inherit the negative consequence of exposure experienced by their ancestors, sustaining impact long after the original chemical is cleaned up or
that
broken
is mad.
Down. That's kind of mad, isn't it? But that makes sense in a way about how it can happen. And as I said, I only learn about that as well, because I mean, I have a whole chapter in my book on beating brain fog about mm-hmm. hormones, because hormone changes can impact on how your memory functions and various other things. And so, yeah, I found that absolutely fascinating when I read the research on that, about how it can kind of progress on to next generation. So I'm a bit like you, anyone listening, trying to get my head around that whole epigenetics thing. But it does make sense. If something changes your hormones, that can influence, you know, the makeup of your sperm and your eggs, and they go on to make the next human being.
Fucking
so
hell.
Yeah, it's mad stuff.
I think we'll leave it at that, Sabina, because I'm conscious of your time. But thank you so much for that chat. That was lovely. That was really informative.
Thank you.
I got an element of therapy for it as well, because there was certain stuff that, I don't know, just the change of, like, I'm seeing in myself certain negative mental health patterns coming back to me.
Coming back
just
again.
Hearing someone say that, like, sure, of course, there's massive change. These are one of the things that will cause old patterns to reemerge. I'm like, fuck it. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
This is just part of the process of the pandemic. So thank you there to my guest, Sabina Brennan. That was a really enjoyable chat. I'll catch you next week. I'll probably have a hot take. All right? In the meantime, enjoy the weather. Rub a dog. Be compassionate to yourself. Have a bit of self-compassion. Can't go wrong with some self-compassion. Forgive yourself. Yurt.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.